Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford with January 24th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world, as will be the case next Wednesday, the 31st of January. Whatever stirring words may come out of the mouths of heads of state protecting the civil liberties of their citizens and their right to publicly protest against policies and actions they may disagree with are not, it should be assumed, high on their agenda. It is equally true when they speak of how such cases are handled in other countries where their only criteria is whether the country in question is an ally or foe. This arguably has been true of all American presidents, but none as crudely as President Trump in his tweets supporting the spate of anti-government protests across Iran that began in December that were echoed by his mouthpiece in the UN, Nikki Haley. This was underscored by Haley's futile effort to get the UN Security Council to take up Iran's relatively muted response to the protest, apparently believing she could get it to pass a resolution of condemnation or threaten Tehran with further sanctions. She got neither. During a special meeting of the council she had called for January 5th, Haley pushed her colleagues to invoke Article 34 of the UN Charter over the reaction of Iran's security forces to the protesters, charging that, quote, "Member states cannot use sovereignty as a shield when they categorically deny their people human rights and fundamental freedoms," end quote. Her British counterpart, Matthew Rycroft, while acknowledging that the Council is, quote, empowered through Article 34, end quote, pointed out that Iran's actions failed to meet the qualifier of the article, quote, "to investigate any dispute that might give rise to international friction." This one didn't. Trump's over-the-top tweets on the subject you couldn't miss hearing on NPR or whenever you turn on the media. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to discuss the background of the Iran protest, as well as what's going on in Syria today, and the way Americans view those protests with former CIA analyst and Takes on the World guest Paul Pillar, which he explored in a recent article on Consortium News titled "Gazing at Iran Through a Distorted Glass." With any country that, like Iran, has been the subject of acrimonious debate in Washington, writes Pillar, pronouncements by American observers about events in that country have more to do with politics here than with what is going on over there. So it has been with much of the spinning and interpreting of protests in Iranian streets. Some guidelines for intelligent, responsible, and useful commentary on those protests are in order and applicable, writes Pillar, no matter what are the policy preferences of whoever is commenting, end quote. Well, there's been another important string of protests that you haven't been hearing about lately, since unlike what has been taking place in Iran, they have been against the government of a U.S. client state, Honduras. Last December, NPR and the rest of the mainstream media gave considerable coverage to protests that took place in Honduras after what an apparent majority of its voters and the governments of the Americas, with a notable exception of the United States, considered to be a fraudulent presidential election. When they returned to power, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was put in office through a U.S.-supported coup in 2009. The deeply flawed ballot counting process included long delays blamed on computer glitches, which saw Hernandez's early 5% deficit behind opposition candidate popular TV host Salvador Nasralla mysteriously disappear and have him reemerge with a narrow 1.5% victory. The vote was denounced by numerous observers, including the Organization of American States, which has called for new elections. The Trump administration ignored the call and quickly recognized Hernandez as the winner. While the protests have continued through this past weekend, there have been no reports on NPR and next to nothing in other mainstream media since the middle of December, despite the fact that more people have been killed by government forces in Honduras than in Iran. On Monday, Democracy Now! Broke through the silence with a report on last Saturday's protest and a comment from Salvador Nasralla, his candidate. Hernandez is scheduled to be sworn in for his second term on January 27th, Saturday, a day on which the country's opposition alliance has announced a nationwide strike. The leader of the opposition alliance is former President Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in the 2009 coup backed by then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. One of whose emails made public called for him not to be allowed to resume his office. Amnesty International has accused the government deploying, quote, dangerous and illegal tactics to silence any dissenting voices, end quote. While the United Nations and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights have denounced torture of detainees in military installations and said they were, quote, alarmed by the illegal and excessive use of force to disperse protest, end quote. But the U.S.-backed government has rejected a request by the Organization of American States to send a special delegate to investigate abuses. Honduran officials have downplayed the deaths, claiming gang members are behind the protest. Earlier this month, demonstrators opposed to the Honduran president took garbage bags full of waste to a U.S. military base, ripped them open, and strewed the contents at the feet of the soldiers on duty there. Their message was plain, wrote Judy Weber in the Financial Times of London. The English press has covered this very well. The base is a potent symbol of U.S. power in the Central American country, and the stunt was intended to present as rubbish Washington's endorsement of Hernandez as the winner of the November 26 elections. Moving on. The biggest concern at the moment, at least in Washington, across the Middle East, and in the capitals of U.S. allies and NATO, is most surely Turkey's ongoing attack on U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in northern Syria that began last week, which it has named in Orwellian fashion Operation Olive Branch. It is something I will also be speaking about with former CIA analyst Paul Pilar later in the program. Turkey is Washington's oldest and most important ally in the region, dating back to the beginning of the Cold War. And while the two countries have had their differences in the past, none has been quite like this one. Turkey's actions appear to be directly connected to the announcement by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson last week that U.S. forces currently numbering 2,000 will remain in Syria and train an army of 30,000 predominantly Kurdish soldiers that will be based on the Turkish border. Speaking in a major Syria policy address hosted at Stanford University by the Hoover Institution, Tillerson laid out five U.S. goals in Syria: the defeat of ISIS and al-Qaeda, a U.N.-brokered resolution that requires Bashar al-Assad's ouster, a curb on Iran, conditions for the safe return of refugees, and the complete elimination of remaining chemical weapons. While the focus of U.S. military effort thus far has been on ISIS, Tillerson warned, al-Qaeda is still a grave threat and is looking to reconstitute in new and powerful ways, end quote. Well, if that's still the case, which is questionable, it has received more than its share of weapons from the U.S., which has long tolerated the presence of the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, because it was one of the more effective jihadist militias waging war against the Assad government. Well, additionally, the Secretary of State continued, a total withdrawal of U.S. personnel this time would restore Assad and continue his brutal treatment of his own people, end quote. Well, although the Trump administration has previously wavered on whether regime change had to be part of any political resolution in Syria, in this speech, at least Tillerson made it clear the U.S. would insist on Assad's departure. A murderer of his own people cannot generate the support required for long-term stability, he said. A stable, unified, and independent Syria ultimately requires post-Assad leadership in order to be successful, end quote. What the U.S. media, and none of the politicians of either party, have been willing to point out is that the U.S. has no business having a military presence in Syria or in any other country without that government's permission. That is particularly so when that presence is for the explicit purpose of preventing that government from exercising control inside its own internationally recognized borders. U.S. forces are in Syria without authorization from Congress, which has not even debated the subject, and they have no intentional international mandate from the U.N. to be there. Clearly, the government of the United States recognizes no country's sovereignty other than its own, and now it plans to add Syria to a long list of governments, many of them democratically elected, that our country has violently overthrown. Thanks to the absence of the military draft and the focus of the United States on a plethora of domestic issues, what the U.S. military is doing anywhere in the world seems of little concern to most Americans across the political spectrum. Indeed, when asked on Sunday's Weekend Edition his thoughts about the government shutdown, Senator Bernie Sanders expressed his concern for the welfare of the military in words that no doubt stunned many of his supporters, like myself. We are into almost 4 months of the fiscal year, and Republicans had not yet given us a budget, an annual budget, complained Sanders. And this is not the way you run a $4 trillion entity which is called the United States government. Just the other day, said Sanders, the United States Armed Forces, the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense said it's impossible for him to do his job. It is responsible, it is wasteful, it is dangerous for the Pentagon if they don't have an annual budget. We've got to give it to them, said Sanders. Dangerous for the Pentagon? I'd like to hear Sanders' argument for that. This past week, Vice President Mike Pence has been visiting the Middle East, chatting with the heads of state of Washington's allies, but the main reason for his trip was to visit Israel and become the first U.S. president ever to address the Israeli Knesset. That honor, if one may call it that, is absolutely fitting, because the latest Gallup poll out last week reveals that nowhere in the world is President Donald Trump more revered than in Israel. That Israel also happens to have the most right-wing, unabashedly racist government in the so-called developed world probably has something to do with it. Over the past half century, most American presidents, beginning with Lyndon Johnson, have made support for Israel a hallmark of their foreign and domestic policy with various degrees of enthusiasm. Two that didn't, at least sufficiently to impress Israel's supporters, Jimmy Carter and the first President Bush, would later attribute their failure to win re-election to the opposition of the Israel lobby. For the most part, all of them permitted that powerful lobby led by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, and its allies in Congress to shape Washington's approach to Middle East issues, and in particular, those relating to Israel. Donald Trump has taken the relationship to a new level, as the New York Times' Max Fisher noted on Monday. Quote, within a foreign policy otherwise characterized by its haphazardness, he wrote, the Trump administration has pursued one issue with single-minded intentionality, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. President Trump's actions have consistently expressed a particularly American notion of being pro-Israel, he went on, but it is rooted less in the conflict itself than the United States' own culture wars. Bitter debates over terrorism and tolerance, writes Fisher, polarized along demographic and partisan lines, have primed a faction of Americans who express their identity in part through solidarity with Israelis and opposition to Palestinians. Politicians have long catered to this view, but Mr. Trump is first to make it official policy, Fisher points out. Recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and threatening to close the Palestinian Liberation Organization's office in Washington, that never quite explained in foreign policy terms, resonate domestically, he wrote, as does his administration's withholding of $65 million from Washington's annual $125 million appropriation to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. That's the agency set up by the UN to provide basic subsistence for Palestinians living in refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, as well as the West Bank and Gaza, following their forced departure from their homes and villages in 1948 to make way for the new state of Israel, and in 1967 following Israel's seizure of the West Bank. It was not conceived that UNRWA would still be in existence or needed 7 decades later, but UN Resolution 194, calling for the Palestinians to be allowed homeland, was never accepted by Israel or pushed by the international community. The last president to support that resolution, let alone mention it, was John F. Kennedy. While they may have had some other things in common, when it comes to politics, Donald Trump is no Jack Kennedy. We pay the Palestinians $100 million a year and get no appreciation or respect, Mr. Trump tweeted this month, following the Palestinians' rejection of his decision on Jerusalem, which was clearly anticipated. His decision to cut the UN funding, which that tweet presaged, was actually a compromise, since his UN delegate, Nikki Haley, who behaves as if she also represents Israel, called for a cutoff of the entire $125 million appropriation, but that was opposed by Secretary of State Tillerson and War Secretary Jim Mattis. Israel, by comparison, gets and has been getting for years the equivalent of over $10 million of U.S. taxpayers' money each and every day, and if there's ever a discussion about it in Congress, it is how to give Israel even more. As New York Times columnist Tom Friedman pointed out 2 years ago, after a joint session of Congress that gave Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, 29 standing ovations during and after a speech calling for them to reject President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran, quote, said Friedman, the U.S. Congress is bought and paid for by the Israel lobby, end quote. It was, in fact, the second time Congress had given Netanyahu that many standing ovations. He'd received 29 such ovations at another joint session of Congress in 2011, 2 days after dressing down President Obama in the Oval Office as if he was an errant schoolboy. For those who would suggest that it is Israeli influence on the U.S. government in U.S. elections rather than that of Russia, which requires an investigation by a special counsel, I remind them that the appropriate agency to do that, the Justice Department and its Foreign Agency Registration Agency, is one of Israel's most important occupied territories in our nation's capital. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.